Hello everyone, my guest today is Federica Bressan, a science communicator and author with a background in techno-science and music. Federica has two masters, holds a PhD in computer science from the University of Verona, and her mission is to give science a voice and help it make a deep impact in our society. Federica believes in evidence-based discussions, and today we are going to learn from her about the exciting topic of techno-science. Federica, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for joining. I know you are an author, and maybe before we start with our techno-science topic, it would be good if we hear a little bit more about your latest book.
Yes, well, my book has nothing to do with technology, all right? With COVID, my life changed like it did for many people. And I actually lost my job and sort of ended a career in academia. That's a different story. But long story short, I really put those things to the side and moved to another country, which, interestingly enough, is the country I came from, Italy, but very far away from where I came from. So it's new. I had to learn. I had to know where I was and the culture even. And these life experiences actually led me to tell the story that is in the book and that I'm very happy I can talk about, because I did write it in Italian, and this would be the Italian version, Nel cuore della Tuscia, but it is available in English and in Dutch, also as an ebook, very easily available online. And it's called In the Heart of Tuscia. Tuscia being, it's spelled like this, Tuscia being the region, the area of Italy where I live right now. So nothing to do with technology.
Oh, nice.
Though. Although I don't know, for the geeks in your audience, I first wrote this in LaTeX. All right. So not with a word processor, but with LaTeX, which is what I used to use for my academic papers. And I'm just a nerd that way.
Nice. Interesting. Yeah. Well, good luck with the new book. I hope it'll be a bestseller. So, Federica, can we first define techno-science in simple terms?
Well, you know, science today is technology-driven, pretty much, right? We use it to do science, and sometimes the science is about developing new technology. That may be more applied science, but there is no, not just field of science, but I would say area in our lives today that is not impacted by technology. So the keyword that really, you know, got me interested a few years ago when I decided to start my podcast was technoculture, more than techno-science. I was an academic researcher then, so I know about techno-science very well, but it's the impact on society. It's the impact on how we live and on what it means to be human today. So actually, how we construe the idea of the world through technology, that is what I find the sexiest.
Okay. And how did you decide to make this part of your career, or, you know, an important part of your career?
Well, science communication is something that was increasingly more demanded of researchers. It's even part of grant applications now for funding. So you have to not just say what you're going to do during your research, but how you're going to communicate it to, you know, an audience of peers and the audience at large. But there's a difference. Kids in school or popularization events, festivals, or are you going to start your own podcast? Guilty as charged. Are you going to write? Do you have a blog? And the sky's the limit there. You can be very creative. I loved doing that, so I started a podcast, for example, and that took a life on its own then, because I'm not sure I'm going to have a chance to elaborate a bit more, but it did start as an integral part of my research, and then it took on its own life. But I was also very conscious that it's not for everyone, and that being a scientist and a researcher, although we always think of the person with the lab coat in the lab, now we have lots of researchers in other fields and in the humanities too. So when I say researcher, I mean every scholar. It's a very demanding job, and I think that you should focus on it, and I think that you're entitled to spend your time doing the one thing you're, I was going to say paid for, but now you're paid also to do dissemination. But this insistence on having a double role, I was critical of. I embraced it because I loved it, but I understand it's not for everyone.
I see. Can you please elaborate on some of the ways you see technology shaping human behavior and culture today in the modern world?
Any other easy question for me? You know, when I started technoculture and other activities I have done, even some research project I wanted to write, I found myself precisely interested in that question. How is technology shaping what it means to be human today, which is our experience in the world? I can give you a very simple example. What's the difference between being dumped by a boyfriend or girlfriend in person or via text message? We said, oh my God, you know, it's so impersonal. But we had letters and phone calls before, so it's not that we only had face-to-face interaction and now it's what's up. How does it change to go to a bookstore? So it means to go there, to meet the people, to be exposed to whatever else is there, other titles, and speak to a person, pay and go home, maybe stop for coffee with a friend or buy on Amazon. You don't have to leave your couch. That changes our habits. But the answer, what's the difference? How does it change? I actually don't believe that can be named as beyond words. And therefore, my approach when I started the podcast was to talk around it, was to explore all the different areas in which technology has an impact on our lives and to talk about that so that kind of in the overall, at the end, you would get an idea, a general idea, of a feeling almost of what it means to be human today.
I see. Very interesting field, now that you've explained what it is, this intersection between society and technology and how we as humans are shaped by that, whether consciously or unconsciously. Maybe a lot of the things now we take for granted, like TVs and mobile phone, but we underestimate how much this is changing us as human beings. I can think of a very simple example, which is probably, we hear commonly these days about short attention spans, especially from the young generation, right? And this prevalence of ADHD, so attention deficit disorder. Is it ADHD? Yeah, probably. So, so these things are for sure impacted or provoked probably by the overusage of screens and mobile phone and very fast communication. Do you think we as human being have not understood the full implication and ramification of having technology take over our lives to the, you know, to that extent? Or you know, is this part of it anyway, and adopting and relying on technology is anyway going to change a lot of parts or a lot of areas in our lives, and not all of it is going to be for the better?
I think there's something to be said about that, because what do we mean by technology in the first place? Technology is what we're using now to communicate, IT technology, but I mean a fork is technology, that so that I don't eat with my hands. So we mean, you know, computer-based technology and multimedia and mobile technology and the internet, all this new stuff. This is what we normally mean when we say technology today. But this has not arisen overnight. So there has always been a technological evolution with many revolutions along the way. So I don't believe that we have not understood the full extent to which this impacts our lives. It's always been an evolution, like society and technologies have co-evolved. And I find this very intriguing. Something that can be said, though, that's specific, because there's something specific about each era in history, is that nowadays we seem to be more and more reliant, dependent on certain technologies for which you need electricity, for example, or, you know, battery, power storage. Because if just the internet goes down, or if one of the services we use online goes down in 2 minutes, you have the people reporting it on the websites. Is this website down? Imagine if a couple of those went down together. Probably we would have, you know, a panic. But then something else that should always be kept in mind is also, what do we mean by people, world, where we are? There are certain even I would say just neighborhoods in some cities where there's lots of technology. I don't know, the high, tall skyscrapers, you know, if power goes out, you're actually stuck right there with the lift. I don't live in such area. I don't have a fridge that talks to me yet. I don't have much domotics. So it's not that I cannot have access to my house if the gate closes electricity. All of those things, that is something to think about, actually. The more and more we surround ourselves with that, and technology about our health, imagine that. Some devices you may have outside of yourself, but also inside of yourself for monitoring.
My next question is about ethical implications of, you know, emerging technologies. So we hear about biotechnology, genetic engineering, all these things. These are scientific advancements. Now, the question is, what are some dilemmas, ethical dilemmas, that you find most pressing in today's technological landscape? And how do you think we can address them as a society?
I would say speak for myself, meaning that there are researchers and scholars that actually focus on ethics and how to deal with those things. I can speak as a bit of a tech geek and someone who's been doing this for a while. So what I see is always a tendency in the media to talk about technology like it does think by itself. Oh, this technology does this. Oh, my God. And my assumption is always technology is what we make of it, is what we make it do. And therefore, there needs to be clear responsibilities there that would include the bias in AI and accessibility. Who has access to certain technologies? And I would go so far to say, what is the design of those technologies? What kind of user you have in mind when you develop your interface and the strategy for, you know, human-machine interaction? That is all part of what will define our final experience of using that technology. But that doesn't just happen. Someone designs it. And I was listening to some other episodes of your podcast, and someone was mentioning how politics always plays a big part in what just seems to be the market or technology. So there's that. So you see, when we speak about technology, unless we are going into the details of a specific system that we break down, like technically, we always talk about society, humans, politics and responsibility and experiences and inclusivity and equity and all of those things. So the main dilemma that I see, like a meta question, is for who is going to take care of all of these different questions in a way that we understand as a society, we need to address them, and we should stop the rhetoric of talking about technology like it's just happening. Like the new stuff just happened in the lab. Someone designs those things. And so we should be very aware, especially, I believe, as a public. We believe we don't have much power, but we should know someone is responsible and someone should be held responsible.
Absolutely, absolutely. You mentioned AI, which is the big technology that is currently taking over, and everybody's talking about it. So do you think governments or regulatory bodies should play a role in overseeing the development or deployment of technologies like AI?
I'll tell you a dilemma in the dilemma that I have about that. As a tech geek, like someone who enjoys seeing the advancement of technology. So Europe is normally more conservative, whereas just stereotypically speaking, research in the United States is kind of more free. That's why you have the big unicorns over there, you know. Yeah. And I'm happy I'm in Europe, but like I said, I enjoy seeing the technology happen. And by the time that certain bodies that are meant to be there to regulate and protect us have taken one decision, you know, some new companies and startups have advanced by 10 steps ahead. So I don't believe that we should regulate technology as it happens and as it progresses, because not only we would slow it down and harm progress, but we should be fast in keeping an eye on it. But I don't believe that we should regulate people who do research development and investments in new stuff. Before they make it, they shouldn't ask for us our permission to do something, because much technology has started as one thing and then developed as something else. So it needs to be free, but I am not for a non-regulation and all of those things. So it's very delicate what I just tried to express in English, which is not my first language. I'm sorry. The point is, I don't believe it. Like, probably a very socially acceptable answer from my part would have been, of course, I believe we should regulate because of this and that danger. I actually believe that there should be freedom to experiment. We should just be smart enough to be fast enough to say, hey, watch out, maybe slow down there, but not that regulation should involve research, as it does already in some areas. Now, you can't do something unless you ask for permission first and they tell you yes or no. No, I don't believe in that.
Okay. Even, do you think this is even applicable to fields like biology or biotechnology, where sometimes, you know, there are some ethical, like maybe clearer ethical dilemmas? I don't know, like experimenting with stem cells and human embryos and all that. Do you think there, maybe the question is more valid, or you know, there should be maybe some regulations, what is permitted, what is not permitted?
The way I'm going to answer that is actually who funds it? Where does it happen? Having worked in academia for many years and having been passionate about the history of science, etc., I immediately go to where something happens. What are the conditions? Who does it? Now, everyone works in a team. Back in the day, 200 years ago, you could have, you know, the lonely scientist, genius working at home, for example, with the wife or a help. And I believe that if it's like a governmental body, a public institution that funds this type of research, of course, there should be questions there. But because there is a mission, there is a vision, there are values, there is a reason why they decided to invest in that. Normally, you know, there's a vision. They want to get somewhere by doing that. So, of course. Now, we don't have the lonely researcher, scientist, med scientist working at home anymore. But whatever the equivalent of that may be, today, I believe that probably, you know, just experiment. Of course, you're more free because you don't have to immediately report to a supervisor that's already there. You have to report to your conscience and to society in the end. But it's different if the research that you talked about, we experiment with stem cells, etc., where it happens. Because, again, it doesn't just happen in the void or out of the blue. Yeah. There's a plan.
Okay, I see what you mean. So it really depends. It's a case by case, and it depends on who's actually conducting the research, who's sponsoring it, which location it's being done. So all these parameters, you know, influence. Some things may be permitted in some jurisdictions, but not in others, right? This is what you're saying.
And I'm also saying that because much of modern science is publicly funded and it requires, especially in the hard sciences, large equipment, so you don't have the individual genius working alone, if you ever had that.
Okay.
That means that what you do research about is not as free as we would like to think. In fact, my first opinion piece that I published, I published on LinkedIn, so not an academic paper, was called Science is Not a Service, because I was getting angry at the cognitive dissonance of still being an academic researcher and hearing about the idealistic view of science as this free endeavor, and then what was required of researchers, which is ever more specific and detailed, including the hot topics, trending topics, which is not just a trend. It's that you must do research on stuff that solves societal issues. So because they pay you, you have to do research on the relevant stuff, which is green energy or AI, all these things. You're not free to do the research you truly want. On top of that, there's so much wrong with academia, because whatever you do, it needs to be groundbreaking, revolutionary, and whereas science, proper science, is just done baby step by baby step, and then some groundbreaking stuff happens every now and then. So there's much wrong with academia. And what I'm saying by that is that the research that we are going to see happen somehow is already written in the agenda, definitely. That is, again, shall I say the magic word, the P word, political, that the funding agency have decided
or
already.
Or corporate.
So
that was my, what you just mentioned prompted me to ask you this next question. A lot of the research that we see, especially around topics like nutrition or medicines or, you know, like these types of things, are most of the time sponsored by companies. Do you think in reality there is some conflict of interest when it comes to these findings and these research in the first place?
Well, the politically correct answer will be, yeah, of course, and it's a concern. But again, I'm a tech enthusiast. So I say, go ahead and show me.
Yeah.
Do you have a good idea? Develop it, and maybe it's very useful. Conflict of interest is just a dirty expression, but I don't think we should take it to the extremes of, I don't know. No, I don't have any example. I think it's pretty clear what I'm trying to say. So I'm saying there can be a conflict of interest that leads to a non-desirable outcome, but it's not necessarily so. So go ahead and show me, and then we'll talk.
I understand. I understand what you mean. The reason I asked the question is, like, recently, for example, some research around nutrition is promoting, like all meat diets. And then if you look at the research, at the companies that are funding those researchers that say, you know, if you eat all meat, you're going to be in a better health, etc., are mostly companies that are in the meat business, you know, like could be, you know, restaurants that sell meat, or you see, or like import-export companies that, you know, deal with meat. So a lot of these things are happening these days. Same thing with the other, you know, with the flip side of the coin, like when you see a research that is promoting vegan diets, etc. Most of the time, the companies that are funding that are companies that sell, let's say, vegan food or vegan supplements. So this is very common, I think, nowadays. And this is where I referred, like, they are basically funding research that back what they sell already. So is this something very common in academia or in research? That's not academia, that's rather research.
No, I want to address the whole first part of your question besides this last twist on academia. Tell me if I'm wrong, but I would like to point out that in your question, you were talking about selling, promoting a product. Research was not there. You just said this influencer is promoting the lion diet and these companies back her up. Where is research there? It's just selling the product. So that's marketing and what's wrong with marketing. And I don't care what, here is where we could find an intersection. I am skeptical of everything that begins with some studies show that, because you can easily, you know, steer. And then what is one study or several recent? I'm skeptical. And this is very tricky because science nowadays is very much a religion. It's science. Science says, I would like to go back to some intelligence, reason, common sense. Let's talk about it before we say science, end of story. So whatever they say as a consumer, if I hear someone pushing the lion diet like that, I don't care what they back it up with or what company backs it up. I don't think I would embark on that diet. I don't think it's good for you, good for me. And I'm not going public to advocate for anything like that. I'm just saying, me as a consumer, I don't go for that, but it's marketing and advertisement, sales, not research, really, what you talked about. Would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you that you know, influencers promoting those products or those types of diets, that's part of marketing. But there is some cases where an actual research, like where, you know, they select a cohort of people and then they run studies for like 100 days. And then they come up with a result like, you know, they were on a lion diet for 100 days and then their health markers are now much better. And then you find out who's actually backing that, who's actually funding that research. You find a lot of the time corporations, could be McDonald's, could be, you know, other big corporations backing. These things exist. One example is in diabetes. In the past few years, diabetes type 2, you know, is a very common lifestyle disease. It was found that in the American diet, for example, or in the American Health Authority, they usually advise people who have diabetes type 2 to eat everything but in moderation and avoid certain types of carbs, let's say. I don't have the full information, but then you look at, and this is based on a certain study, but then you go, you check who actually funded that study. It's actually companies like McDonald's and others, because it's in their best interest to have everybody eat their product. So that's what I was referring to. So even in research, it looks like companies and corporations do play a role in what is being studied in the first place. And as you just said, they can steer it in a certain direction that actually makes them look good rather than bad.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I think a big keyword. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, no. You wanted to say something. Go on.
Well, you know, I can be a critical thinker, but I don't want to just demolish. So I would like to take the sides of science here, for example. I believe that it's a good time to introduce the word trust. So these companies fund studies, scientific studies, that someone peer-reviewed. So they're legitimate scientific studies. But we were kind of skeptical of the results because, you know, you can steer things a little bit. Now, I wouldn't say that a scientific study, just because it was funded or conducted by a certain company, is not valid. I just said a few minutes ago that I'm kind of skeptical of everything that begins with one study shows, okay, because that's never enough to prove anything.
Yeah.
But then trust, again, you know, I wouldn't be willing to not trust a study conducted or funded by McDonald's a priori. Maybe it's a good one, but trust is a key word. And I have learned all the best things I know about trust in science from Maarten van Dijk, who is a historian of science. And that would be my last or second last episode on the Technoculture podcast. So I do refer you to that one interview because it's brilliant, I believe. And there he explains, you know, in context today, including now COVID, because I think the interview was 2 years ago, in context, what it means to trust science. What is this trust? What do we trust? The science or the institution of science? So when McDonald funds a scientific study and you're skeptical, what do you not trust? The science or who did the study, who conducted the study? It's subtle. And this subtle things in the media are never covered. The tones of the debate is always simplistic. And thank you for taking this time to at least touch on these topics.
Yeah, thank you. And, you know, you brought also a very important, you know, topic that I wanted to also address today, which is basically we live in an era where, you know, everybody's connected, everybody now has a say, everybody can pretend to know. So it's an era really of misinformation and almost pseudoscience, right? So everybody now has an opinion on diseases and what's the best cure or, you know, what is the next, you know, discovery and what to do and what not to do. So in this difficult era where everybody has a say and everybody has an opinion, whether on scientific topics or less advanced topics, how do you think, or the question is, what do we need to do to make sure that we are listening to the right advice, like right scientific advice, and not fall prey to this misinformation that we see everywhere now on the internet?
I love your questions. So I would say that your question is targeting the citizen and our people. Because I would say, how do we make sure that we don't add to the noise or that we can trust some information? And I were someone in a professional in the communication field or an agency, like one of those bodies that releases official documents, then I would have the responsibility to make sure that the information I'm spreading is good. Okay. As a citizen, interestingly enough, I would first of all say, but how much scientific information do you need in your daily life to live your life, really? If you're just interested in a topic, you can read here and there and form your own opinion, but it won't make much of a difference. During COVID, it was different because what we were reading about how vaccines are developed and how viruses work was not just for our culture and leisure. It changed our lives. So that was science that needed to be critically communicated. And don't even get me started on that because it was a special time and lots to say there. My answer, therefore, would be, sure, it's a fair question to say, who do I listen to for certain scientific information? But I'm sorry, love, to undermine your question and say, as also someone who has done science communication, I say, regular people in their everyday life, which is hard enough, they're barely interested in hearing about the new science. When you watch documentaries, it's just sharks all the time. AI now, because it's sexy, some space exploration. It's always that stuff. It's not really, you know, frontier research that any postdoc does. It's still the big trend. Yeah. And so the regular folks in everyday life, I don't know that they are so pressured with knowing to what reliable scientific source to turn to, just because they don't really need it in their everyday life. Now, if they read on some mainstream media magazine, you know, 2 eggs a week are good for you, or 5 cups of coffee every day is too much, and those articles say, because some recent studies show, as a general rule of thumb, I would just tell the reader, don't trust. Be skeptical. I'm not saying don't trust, like it's not true. Keep an open mind.
Yeah.
If you're really interested by that because you're super into eggs or coffee, read something else. But for stuff like that, that would impact what you eat and drink also, listen to your body. And this would bring us back, and I close with this, with the importance of good education and culture, because we're humans. There's so much more in this life than technology and also than science, which is just one source of knowledge in
of
life.
Knowledge.
Right? So, you see.
I agree with you. I agree with you. We should trust science, but we should not fall into the mistake of what we call scientism, right? Scientism is
good.
We don't believe in anything else but science. And right? And, you know, there are like a lot of other ways to find truth in life. You know, there's philosophy, there's arts, there's beauty. I mean, these things are not scientific, but you can know the truth by following them as well, right?
Very much. Very much so. Very much
okay.
so.
Okay. Yeah. Now, going back to technologies and the future and, you know, science in general and discoveries. So what excites you most about the potential for technological innovation and, like, you know, in the next few years? And what concerns do you have about the direction that it might take if we don't, you know, you said we have to keep an eye on all these things and all those discoveries before they get sometimes out of control. So what are some fields that you are excited about that you know are going to be very promising in the next few years?
For me, I'm very excited about self-driving cars. I want one.
Okay.
I need one. I look forward to them being common, you know, because... Yeah, that would be my number one thing. Of course, like AI is a whole world. Up until a few years ago, you could still say, I'm into AI. Oh, yeah. But now whoever says I'm into AI, you have to say, okay, tell me what field, what aspect of it. It's too broad. It's too large. It's life. So I will stick to self-driving cars, although, of course, the potential of AI is something I really look into. What does not excite me about AI is simulating human emotions or having androids or like whatever, replicating anything human. I want it to give me a better service when I need a service, you know, answering questions and stuff like that. Doing stuff for me and answering questions. I wouldn't be impressed if it felt emotions. I'm not into AI for that. And concerns, I would imagine, are about accessibility. So how these things are going to be made available to the population as regions in the world, as well as price. You know, if it's useful stuff, if it's not a fancy gadget, but if it's useful stuff, also I keep a special eye on the medicine field because there's much research there with lots of technology, also for implants, devices, implants, you know, full limbs.
Yes.
I'm sorry, I don't have the language for that. That is very exciting.
Artificial limbs, yes.
And that should be definitely accessible.
Okay. Do you worry that, looking at the speed with which AI is now taking over, do you worry that in the next 10 or 20 years, things might not look as good as we would hope for. Like, and then people would probably, you know, have those Android-like human beings that are robots, that are doing things that we used to do, and then a lot of jobs will be lost, or some relationships will be broken because people will have, you know, unhealthy relationships with AI entities. Do you worry that these might happen, or you don't think this is going to happen?
Oh, do you have anything against me dating an android?
I mean, these days, these questions are now being asked, right? I mean, maybe 20 years ago, that wasn't, you know, a sane question to ask. But these days, you know, even those questions are now something that we should discuss.
Well, first of all, I love science fiction literature and books like, is it Kurzweil, the name of the author, called The Age of Spiritual Machines, is now 20 plus years old.
Okay.
So we've always been thinking about these things.
Okay.
I'm not someone who thinks machines will take over. That doesn't mean I'm very optimistic. Okay. I'm neither pessimistic or optimistic. I just seem, by personal view, to believe that what can go wrong will, because we're humans and we like to play around with these things. I also was interested in cybersecurity and the metaverse. These are places, scenarios where old crime is brought to a new scenario, and it's the same type of crime with the same type of bad people plus something new that comes up because of that new scenario. So I'm neither optimistic nor pessimistic, because if there's such thing, I'm both at the same time. I just know, well, actually, it's not that nonsensical. I know, and I hope to live to see that we are going to receive immense benefits from the technology that's to come. But of course, there are going to be accidents, crime, and something like that. Actually, we have such a short memory. As a tech fanatic and being technology everything, I also watch documentaries on how, in fact, electric power was brought to citizen homes, or, you know, all this, the Victorian home, and the type of wallpapers they used, which was chemical, which was modern, was new, it's technology, or how they heated the electric stove. They had massive accidents, but that didn't stop progress, because we loved what it did for us. It's good to have electricity. So you see, this is my position for the future. It's going to be very exciting, and I hope to live to see that as much as possible. But of course, there's going to be some train wreck down the way. And what I hope to see in the media, but there I'm pessimistic, because this is what they like to do, is that they don't demonize the technology and spread stupid panic among the population, like AI is bad. No, it's not.
I agree with you. At the end of the day, the technology is just, it's a thing, right? The AI isn't bad intrinsically. It's human beings that can be good or bad. They can use it for the good, or they can use it for the bad, right? So it's what we do with AI that matters, not the technology itself. Cool. All right, Federica, it's been a really exciting talk with you. Do you have any final words that you'd like to share with us?
Buy my book? No, I mean, lead a good life, you know, and enjoy your technology. Yeah. Do enjoy the technology, but, you know, stay human. I have a tattoo on my arm over here. It says, stay human. So from a tech geek podcasting nerd, take it from me. Stay human.
Yes, that's a message that I agree with for sure. Let's use technology, but not let technology take over our lives and then make us cease to be human. This is very important indeed.
I'm big on that. Like, technology should serve us. Technology should serve us. And this is probably what we should teach children, besides programming and all those things. It's your position with respect to technology. Technology should serve you, not vice versa, which has implications for interface design, accessibility, and how much technology made our lives more complicated to do certain things it shouldn't be. And that's not technology's fault per se, but who designed it. So, yeah, you see, this is culture. This is not tech. This is culture. It's techno-culture. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you, Federica. That was a very exciting talk.
Thank you.